said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with an old friend, Dennis Kelleher. He's the co-founder, CEO, and president of Better Markets, which he co-founded with Mike Masters. It's a 501c3 based in Washington, D.C., that was created to wrestle with all the industry groups and alligators in the financial sector. Before that, he was a senior staff person for many years at the United States Senate. We spent a lot of time working together during the Dodd-Frank reform years and after the TARP legislation. And before that, Dennis spent 20 years at Skadden Arps as an attorney and, you've looked at things from almost every vantage point, from philanthropic, from, government responsibility as a staff member and from representing people in the private sector. Dennis, thanks for joining me. I really look forward to catching up with you today because since the pandemic started, we haven't had our usual meetings.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. I'm looking forward to it myself.
So right now, I sense that the stridency, the confidence of, quote, experts or people who, thump the tub and talk as though we should all know what's going on, are humbled. That we have a group of people now who don't quite know if governance or design or what have you is coherent, whether in particular with a zoom lens, the financial sector is safe, whether the healthcare system works right, how we're doing criminal justice, how we're doing the prison industrial system. I guess what I'm saying is we've unmasked a tremendous amount of skepticism. And from your perch with all of your different vantage points of experience, I'm curious, what concerns you? What do you see that's laudatory? What do you see that's missing? What do you see that scares you?
I'm so glad this podcast is going to last for at least 3 hours so we can cover all that. But let's start with kind of the big picture, which is the intersection of economics with finance. I mean, Warren Buffett said, you don't know who's swimming naked until the tide goes out. And the pandemic, once again, is the tide going out. And that has not revealed, but confirmed yet again, that the economy in the United States simply does not work for the vast majority of Americans. I mean, when within 2 weeks, way more than 50% of Americans, probably more than 70% of Americans, live paycheck to paycheck and literally are a paycheck away from a food bank and being evicted from their apartments or from their house. And these aren't part-timers. These are people who work full-time year in and year out and work very hard. And yet they don't have any cushion to fall back on. They don't have savings by and large, and they don't have the financial means or wherewithal or access to it to survive even a very temporary interruption of wages. And you have to ask yourself, how can that possibly be that 70%+ of the American people work their tails off full time and be in such a precarious economic circumstance? That by definition means that the economy is not working for the vast majority of the American people. And we know there's been this huge transfer of wealth, basically from the 90% of Americans to the top 10% over the last several decades, but accelerated quite a bit over the last two decades. And you have to wonder what is going on here. And there's a lot of reasons it's going on, and it can be a big problem, and it can become paralyzing when people think about it. But one of the key reasons, and one of the reasons we focus on at Better Markets, is that the financial system is too often a wealth extraction mechanism for the few rather than a wealth creation system for the many. We have to remember the financial system is supposed to serve society and support the productive economy by essentially providing the financial fuel for individuals and businesses, either on the one hand to start a business and to grow a business and to hire more people, or for an individual to get a loan for their house or to go to school or things like that, all of which should be flowing into supporting the real productive economy. And yet our financial sector has been more engaged in gambling activities that enrich themselves and the 1%, the hedge fund guys, the private equity guys, all these financiers who are getting fantastically wealthy, but it's at the expense of everybody else, which is why we call it a financial extraction, a wealth extraction mechanism rather than a wealth creation system. And that ultimately led to the crash of 2008. Now, that's the simplest way to think about it, is the biggest banks in the United States got bigger, and they engaged in more and more dangerous and high-risk trading and investment activities, having almost nothing to do with the real economy and Main Street families and businesses. And so the crash happens, and Congress, overcoming really unbelievable odds, enacted a pretty good financial reform law called Dodd-Frank. And Dodd-Frank wasn't a perfect law, but there are no perfect laws. And the Dodd-Frank financial reform law of 2010 was the best financial reform law our political system could produce at the time. And given the hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, the financial industry spent trying to kill it, including by purchasing hundreds and thousands of lobbyists, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 of them were prior congressional staffers and elected officials, not only just to influence the legislation as it was being considered, but actually to kill it. And they were unsuccessful, and the law was enacted, but unfortunately, that law, like most laws, are not self-executing. And so what happened with the Dodd-Frank financial reform law is it gets sent to all the financial regulatory agencies, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, the Federal Reserve Board, the FDIC, which is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and several other financial regulatory agencies. And unfortunately, the financial industry decided to once again engage in trench warfare to win in the rulemaking process what they lost in the legislative process. And that had been going on really since July of 2010 when President Obama signed the Dodd-Frank Act. But the whole point of that process, and the reason I bring it up, is because it was aimed at changing the Wall Street wealth extraction mechanism and reorienting it more towards a wealth creation system. And the way it was going to do that was to reduce the highest risk, most dangerous activities of the biggest financial institutions, protect investors and consumers, and try and force these banks to get more into banking, actual banking for Main Street families and businesses, and away from the dangerous high-risk gambling. And that has been what has been going on for 10 years, not in the newspapers, not in the headlines, but in the trenches of Washington, D.C. financial regulatory agencies and the courts. And normally, Wall Street's biggest financial institutions and its army of lawyers and lobbyists and sundry other supporters, including many, many elected officials, and normally they get their way in that process because they aren't opposed. And they aren't opposed because finance can be very complicated. and rulemaking and policymaking can be equally complicated. And Better Markets was actually founded in October of 2010 for the sole purpose of being a powerful substantive counterweight to Wall Street's biggest firms throughout that policymaking process. And that's what we've been engaged in at Better Markets for about 10 years. And really what the goal is to protect and promote the economic security, opportunity, and prosperity of the American people by having a financial system that gets back into the business of banking and supporting Main Street families and businesses, and away from this kind of crazy gambling where they really are focused solely on boosting their bonuses and not giving a damn about the consequences for our financial system, our economy, and certainly not for Main Street families and businesses. And so we're at that point now where you work through that for a number of years, and then lo and behold, the coronavirus hits and the pandemic happens. And the good news, if I can put good news in quotes, is that we didn't actually have a financial crisis at the onset of the pandemic. We had a stock market crash. We had a financial system freeze up in the March 2020 period when the pandemic started really hitting hard. And yet, there was not a banking crash or crisis. And that was because the rules that were put in place over the last 10 years forced the banking industry generally and the biggest banks on Wall Street in particular to have a lot more capital, a lot more liquidity, and have a lot more limitations on their gambling. And it's only because of those rules that the onset of the pandemic at the beginning of this year did not also cause a massive banking crash like we saw in 08. And it's those rules are also why we didn't see massive bailouts like the TARP bailout that was enacted in the fall of 08. We didn't see that in the spring of 2020 because those rules were in place. I had to laugh when you saw all these CEOs of the Wall Street's biggest banks talking about how strong they were at the beginning of the year and the pandemic happened. They said, oh, we're strong and we can support the real economy and we can help America's families because of how strong we are and how much capital we have. I had to laugh because the only reason they were strong is because we beat them in the rulemaking process and forced them to have dramatically increased capital and liquidity and other limitations on their activities. They fought those rules tooth and nail. And yet, when the results of those rules put them in such a strong position, they then patted themselves on the back about what a great position they're in. So it was ironic to say the least. But we still see now, 12 years after the 2008 crash, in the middle of the economic crisis caused by the pandemic, that the economy is still not getting the support it should get from the financial system, and it's certainly not getting the support it should get from the government, where Wall Street once again has been treated to unlimited support from the Federal Reserve Bank and from this administration. But Main Street families and businesses have been struggling and basically getting crumbs from the Federal Reserve and getting crumbs from the federal government, where Wall Street's biggest banks and financial institutions are treated to a banquet and the stock market skyrockets and the billionaires increase their billions by hundreds of millions of dollars. And yet we still see historically high unemployment, historically high failure of small businesses on Main Street, and historically high utilization of food banks and other emergency aid organizations. And so we still have this fundamental two worlds in America, one for the already rich and well-connected, and that's, you can call it the top 1%, you can call it the top 10%, and everybody else. And so we have to once again look at the fundamental issues of wealth extraction and wealth creation and the role that finance plays in our economy in the ordinary course, as well as during times of crisis. So I'll stop there because I think that touches on a few of those issues, Rob, but not all of them.
Well, I mentioned to you in some of our earlier conversations that Adair Turner wrote a book for iNet called Between the Debt and the Devil. And what he remarked on was in his running of the Financial Services Administration during the time of the 2008 crisis, it was very evident that the, which you might call meta logic for backing a financial system, is number one, if it goes over the cliff, you bail it out so it doesn't take the real economy down with it. And number two, you have that financial system to facilitate capital investment and therefore productivity growth, which enlarges the pie for everyone. But the problem that Adair saw, the shortcoming, was that almost all of the lending had to do with collateralized real estate that was pumping up asset prices and then down when it stopped, but it didn't contribute to capital formation. That was a completely different process. So now we come to the 2020 episode, and people are saying, well, you know, is it different now? Well, I think some of the sources of the disturbance of the shock was not just what I'll call financial recklessness. The pandemic comes from a different place. But you see a great deal of what I would call the flaws of American political economy, where, as you said, all the highly leveraged private equity, big banks, and so forth get a banquet, and the broad base of the population that you referred to, other than the top 10%, are struggling mightily. And yet, how would I say, we're all going to be paying taxes into working off that debt. We're all going to forego things like education, infrastructure, improved health that could be what we used fiscal capacity for. And as Naomi Klein calls it, we've also seen what she calls a Green New Deal, which is about how the tech sector, with its political power, is being fortified, and those stocks are running up as well. And so, how would I put it? Social sustainability seems to be very much at risk here, and the credibility of governance seems to be quite in the crosshairs, not just because of the pandemic happening, but in watching the distributional impact of the responses. How did this all get started? Was the financial sector always out of kilter, encouraging moral hazard, encouraging excessive risk-taking because they knew the bailouts were there? Or is this something, say, going back to, I don't know, the formation of the Federal Reserve to the present? What do you see? And I also want to note for our listeners that you have a wonderful article in the current, I guess, CNN website is where I read it, about the need for a Department of Economic Security for Main Street, because the lender of last resort that was formed as the Federal Reserve is taking care of finance. And I remember Paul Volcker, rest in peace, but he talked to me about the Fed will lose its independence because they don't buy municipal securities, they don't finance where you might say police departments or health systems or roads and bridges are needed. Municipalities run a budget that in that 2008-2009 crisis has to be balanced, so they end up laying off everybody. Meanwhile, all the toxic things on the balance sheets of banks are picked up by the Fed. And as Volcker said to me, that's a very ugly form of picking winners.
Well, you know, we had many decades of wisdom from Paul Volcker, and it's unfortunate we don't have his wisdom with us now in this latest crisis episode. But I'd like to talk about the Department of Economic Security, but I think it's actually helpful and really illuminating to take the first part of your question and go back in time a little bit. And so, and that is really the question is finance irredeemably prone to excess and collapse and shifting its losses, you know, keeping its gains and then shifting its losses to the public, to the detriment of the public? Are we just forever stuck in that cycle? Or is there something we can do about that? And there's actually very good news when you look at history in thinking about that. And so before the Great Depression, the Great Crash of 1929, followed by the Great Depression of the 1930s, we basically had a time not that different than now, where you basically had financial industry wilding, where anything goes. It was laissez-faire or extreme capitalism. And the biggest financial institutions of the day basically did whatever they wanted. They largely weren't regulated at all. And they certainly weren't policed. And, you know, there were, before the Great Crash in 1929, there were these periodic crashes that were called panics. And the Federal Reserve Bank was actually created in response to the panic of, I think it was 1907, if I'm remembering right. And then it was created in 1913. But it was largely created to bail out the financial industry. And ironically, of course, it was created so that there would be a federal government mechanism to bail out the financial industry. And poor old J.P. Rockefeller himself, maybe not J.P. Morgan, but Rockefeller would not have to do it himself. So in some ways, ironically, the creation of the Federal Reserve was the financial industry externalizing its cost and moving it to the public balance sheet. But and of course, the creation of the Federal Reserve did in 1913 did not stop the financial industry wilding, engaging in, you know, high risk, reckless, and illegal conduct, which led to the Great Crash of 1929 and the Great Depression of the 30s. That's the bad news. The good news is that under FDR, massive changes were undertaken in law and regulation. The Securities and Exchange Commission was created. Glass-Steagall was enacted, which required the investment banking part of banks to be separate from the commercial and residential and Main Street lending part of banks. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation was created. There was this whole panoply of agencies and rules and regulations, as well as, very importantly, the structural separation that Glass-Steagall put in place between the highest risk, most dangerous activities of finance from the Main Street lending part of finance. And what is really important that nobody, or I shouldn't say nobody, but few people think about is that the system, it was a little bit ad hoc, it was multiple laws enacted at different times, but it created layers of protection of different types. There were supervisory layers, regulatory layers, and structural layers between the gambling dens on Wall Street and families on Main Street. And those rules and agencies actually worked for almost seven decades. They worked extremely well. We did not have anything like the 1929 crash until 2008. So, you know, for roughly, you know, you could say by the time the rules were passed, the agencies were created, we had roughly 70 years of, yes, there were ups and downs, and yes, there were recessions, and yes, there were mini bubbles, but there was nothing like 1929. So the good news is that if the United States government has the courage and the political will to rein in big finance, to rein in Wall Street, to regulate it the way it should be regulated so that its excesses do not spill over into the broader financial system and economy, if we have the political will and the courage to do it, we can do it. And we did do it for almost 70 years. That's the good news part of the story. The bad news part of the story is that You know, the financial industry amasses enormous economic power. And over time, it uses that economic power to buy political power, which it uses to increase its economic power. And that's really what happened in the 80s and 90s that laid the groundwork for massive deregulation. By 2000, not all, but most of the Great Depression reforms, the agencies were still there, but they were not working as they should, and they certainly were not prioritizing the public interest. In fact, often they were prioritizing the interest of the financial industry. And by 2000, the financial industry had purchased on a bipartisan basis both almost the entire political system, which then engaged in massive deregulation of the financial industry. And of course, that reached a crescendo in about 2000. And the interesting thing is it only took the financial industry about 7 years to basically blow up the global financial system. So we had 70 years without a major crash, roughly 70 years without a major crash, when our financial regulatory agencies and our political system, as well as the banking culture, acted as a brake on the worst excesses of the financial system. And yet, within about 7 years of the financial industry purchasing broad-based deregulation and, by the way, non-enforcement of the law, from about 2000 to 2007, we ended up in about 7 years with the biggest crash in 2008. The 2008 crash was the biggest financial crash since 1929, and it caused the worst economy since the Great Depression of the 1930s. And so the lesson isn't that finance is too big and powerful to be reined in. And it's the lesson is not that Main Street cannot be protected from Wall Street. History proves both those things are false, and that if we have the political will, then we can protect Main Street from Wall Street. We can make finance serve the broader economy, but it requires financial regulatory agencies to act in the public interest, not as handmaidens to the financial industry. It requires elected officials to actually work in the service of Main Street families and businesses and not just gorge themselves on political contributions from Wall Street and big finance. And that's the real macro lesson history teaches us. And so when we look at the broad sweep of history, the question that we're confronted with, that we were confronted with, you know, Rob, when we worked together, when I was a senior staffer in the Senate in the 08, 09, 2010 period, and in the 10 years that I've been at Better Markets, you know, fighting in the trenches against big finance and the rulemaking process, the litigation process, and the media, and in the legislative arena, the real issue is how do we rebalance finance to get back to that time when Main Street families and businesses were supported by the banking industry, which wasn't a threat to the Main Street families and businesses. And that's the process that we've been going through. And actually, some very significant progress was made until the Trump administration came in, frankly. And, you know, the Trump administration de facto merged the White House with Wall Street. I mean, you don't need to know more than the fact that President Trump hired the president of Goldman Sachs to be the head of national economic policy for the Trump administration. That's exactly the marker of upside down priorities. And so we've endured 4 years now of an administration slavishly in the service of Wall Street's biggest financial firms. A rollback of many of the reforms of Dodd-Frank, although, you know, the good news is that the administration has largely been unsuccessful in destroying financial reform at Dodd-Frank. It has weakened it and has chipped away at some significant parts, but big parts of Dodd-Frank are still in play, as I said earlier, which is one of the reasons why, in spite of the Wall Street firm's lobbyists, it's why the banks were in such a strong position going into 2020, and when the pandemic hit, we didn't have a banking crisis. And now we have to look at it and say, okay, what do we need to do now, given that the economy doesn't work for the American people, given that the government is failing the American people, and given that the financial system is failing the American people? And I mean, there's a number of ideas out there, but as you said, you know, I had a recent op-ed in CNN.com about creating a Department of Economic Security. What the pandemic has shown is not only that the economy doesn't work for the American people, but the government doesn't work for the American people. You know, right now, every day, the Federal Reserve Bank sits ready to flood the financial sector and the financial system with literally unlimited amounts of money to save it from any distress, however defined and however caused. And so from March 3rd until May 28th of this year, roughly 3 months, the Federal Reserve increased its balance sheet by $3 trillion. That was $3 trillion that the Fed created and poured into the financial system. And the most visible evidence of that is a skyrocketing stock market and the enrichment of the already rich on Wall Street, from hedge funds to PE firms, you name it. If you were already filthy rich in the financial industry, the Fed's response of flooding the system with trillions of dollars enriched you even more. And you compare that to what the government's response was to Main Street. And it's almost laughable. It's a patchwork of dysfunctional, ineffective, incompatible programs and agencies trying to do different things. So we have the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program, which was administered by the SBA, the Small Business Administration, one of the, I mean, it's a laughingstock among government agencies and has been for years. Now, in fairness, it was being asked to do something it had no capability to do. But the last thing you want to do when Main Street families and businesses need to be rescued is to assign that rescue to the weakest link. So you have this patchwork of the Small Business Administration, and then they're going to send out stimulus checks through, of all things, the IRS, which is slow, bureaucratic, and doesn't get the job done. And then to make matters worse is a very good idea, which was to increase the unemployment compensation payments. They both broadened it to gig workers and increased it by $600 a week. But the problem with the unemployment insurance system, is that it's actually run by 50 different states, the District of Columbia, and three territories. It's not a federal program. It's a state-run program, and many of the states, like Florida, run those programs in a way that disincentivizes people from participating in them, even when they deserve it, even when they're entitled to it, and underpays them at the same time. So in Florida, in the middle of a pandemic, Florida's position was you could not apply online for unemployment insurance. You had to show up and stand in line with literally thousands and thousands of other people. And so there was this patchwork of programs, however well-intended, that responded to a, you know, literally a national human crisis on Main Street, where unemployment, 30 million people were unemployed within weeks in the United States. It's never been seen before in unemployment levels at that level that quickly. And small businesses crashing into bankruptcy at historic levels also. And so what I have been advocating for is that the federal government create a department that can respond and save Main Street as quickly as the Fed saves Wall Street. After all, why do we have an agency to save a financial system which is supposed to support the real economy, and not have anybody actually focused on protecting and promoting the people who make up the real economy, which are our Main Street families and businesses. So my idea that we've been advocating for is the creation of a Department of Economic Security whose sole objective would be protecting and promoting Main Street families and businesses and ensuring that day-to-day in the ordinary course that they are a priority of the government and, very importantly, that when a crisis comes along, that there is actually a focused and sustained firepower that can rescue Main Street quickly and effectively so that we don't ever have to, as a country, endure what we have endured over the last several months on the economic side, leaving aside the whole issue relating to the pandemic itself and the whole all of the healthcare issues, which also need to be addressed. I'm just focusing on the economic and financial aspects of that. And so we need a Department of Economic Security to do that. At the same time, we need to be policing the financial system. There's essentially no accountability in the financial system now. And there is the Fed is indiscriminately bailing out literally every single financial instrument and firm in the country. Now, we have advocated at Better Markets aggressively from the beginning that the Federal Reserve should be making some judgments as to who they're bailing out. On the one hand, yes, it's nobody's fault that there's a pandemic. And therefore, you shouldn't be sitting around picking winners and losers in the financial industry because of the consequences of a pandemic that's nobody's fault. On the other hand, some judgment should be exercised when you look at those businesses. So, for example, private equity has a predatory business model built on extreme leverage and wealth extraction. As you know, Rob, private equity grabs business, you know, buys businesses, tries to buy them cheap. They strip them of their assets. They extract as much money as possible, and they leverage them up to the hilt, literally to the brink of bankruptcy. Many of those companies would never have survived even a mild cyclical downturn, never mind, you know, a deep, steep downturn due to the pandemic. And in our view, there should be judgments made that predatory business models based on extreme leverage should not be bailed out by the American government. And yet, what you have is a Federal Reserve abetted by this administration, and in particular the Treasury Department, of indiscriminately bailing out and enriching any financial sector actor at all, with just no limitation on what they're doing or how they're doing it. So, for example, there's no limitation. They don't say, we're going to bail you out as long as you don't fire all your employees. No limitations of that. We'll bail you out and you can still fire all your employees, so lay them off. No limitation on extreme and excessive executive compensation, for example. No limitation on capital distributions. The only limitation on capital distributions is the Fed limited partially the biggest banks from some of their capital distributions, and that was after intensive public pressure, including, importantly, from Better Markets, that on a sustained basis in March, April, May, June, just nonstop criticizing the Fed for allowing capital distributions in the form of share buybacks and dividends. And they're still allowing dividends, although they've limited them a little bitty bit. So there's two big challenges before us that we must address in the wake of the pandemic. Once, obviously, the health part of it has to be the priority, has to be the focus. But once that's done, we need to have an institutional capability to protect, promote, and save Main Street families and businesses. And we have to exercise better judgment and reining in and controlling the financial sector, which now, and you know, Adair talked about this in his book, as have others, now it knows, it believes it has effectively a put on the federal government through not just the Fed, but frankly, through on the fiscal side, but it put at any time that there is a downturn that they're going to be bailed out. You know, back in the days of when Alan Greenspan was the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, people referred to it as, was there a Greenspan put? Would Greenspan always bail out the financial sector? Big discussions. People got PhDs writing papers about that. And they fought about whether or not there was this constant, basically, in the Fed insuring all financial instruments, activities, and firms. And then the 08 crash happens, and the Federal Reserve, by one study, the Levy Institute did a comprehensive study that showed that if you added up all the Fed facilities that responded to the 2008 crash, whether it was money lent, spent, used, guaranteed, or otherwise made available or potentially available to the financial sector, it added up to $29 trillion. That's not TARP, right? TARP was $700 billion taxpayer dollars. That was the tip of the iceberg. The bailout for the financial industry really came through the Fed in 2008, 2009, 2010, to the tune of $29 trillion. So then there was a big discussion. Wait a minute. Is there a Bernanke put? Because Ben Bernanke was then the chairman of the Fed. So the question was, well, gee, will the Fed always stand ready to bail out the financial sector? And boom, they did. And now we have another economic and financial crisis, and the Fed opens the spigots and unloads the biggest financial firepower really ever. And somebody says, well, wait a minute, do we have a Powell put? And I think we should start personalizing the concerns about the constant bailouts to the chairman of the Fed and just admit and recognize that based on the policies over the last several decades, that the Federal Reserve Board stands ready at all times to bail out the financial industry whenever there's a problem. And we need to change that, because that creates, as you know, Rob, moral hazard, which means you actually encourage the financial industry to engage in more high-risk, dangerous activities, and in fact, to engage in higher-risk activities, because it's the ultimate social, you know, privatizing profits and socializing losses. They keep the bonuses in the good times, and in the bad times, they move their bad bets onto the public balance sheet, either because they're bailed out by the Fed or by the Treasury. So those two big pieces have to be the central components of the post-pandemic thinking about reorganizing and reprioritizing how the government does or does not take care of Main Street, and why Wall Street is always getting prioritized over Main Street, both because of this institutional capability that is readily available for Main Street with nothing similar for Main Street, and because of this history of bailouts that are disconnected from the very purpose of the financial industry, which is to serve Main Street. And that's clearly not what's happening.
Go back to Paul Volcker, a group that he was very deeply involved with, that I'm sure you know a lot about, it, the Group of 30. And there was a lot of concern at Group of 30 meetings I used to visit sometimes, that the lower house, the House of Representatives, was going to be terrified to ever vote for another TARP. And so they would let the economy crash. And some of the financial experts, former central bankers, Treasury secretaries and the like, said, well, what we've got to do is make sure that there's 100% guarantee that they will not go over the cliff and there will be a bailout, because the consequences of standing back and letting those firms fail is and taking the real economy down with it is much worse. And Volcker, I remember him saying to me, because I walked back to his office with him after the meeting, he said, Robert, there's just no way without some kind of prior restraint that they can do that. There has to be an ability to engage in a prior limitation of what risk you can take if you know you will be bailed out. And then we talked about how all the big banks were guaranteed, where the smaller banks weren't quite as guaranteed. of getting that bailout, and it showed up in their funding costs. And I know scholars like Ed Cain, who's done a lot of nice work for INET research, have shown that the competitive advantage of the large, too big to fail banks is that their funding cost is significant lower, which does two things. It takes market share away from the others who are at risk of failure, and it encourages them to take too much risk, which enlarges the scale of that guaranteed bailout. And Volcker was very, very tuned in to this dilemma, and his question to me in that walk was, what can we do to create credible prior restraint so they can't take advantage of the bailout in the event that the lower house does what they fear, which stands back? If you're going to make it 100% guaranteed, then you got to stop speculation ex ante. Otherwise, the Treasury is going to get soaked with what you might call the contingent liability.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, on the one hand, it is a dilemma. On the other hand, the solution is readily available and apparent. It gets back to political and regulatory will. And so, you know, truthfully, it comes down to the only thing standing between a failing bank and a bailout is the bank's capital. If the bank has sufficient capital, both in terms of quality and quantity, then it should be able to absorb its own losses without failing and without needing a bailout. And indeed, that's one of the reasons we don't have a banking crisis. Now, in fact, we put out a report, Better Markets put out a report in June of this year called No Financial Crash Yet, Thanks to Dodd-Frank and Banking Reforms. And it details exactly what banking reforms created the resiliency of those banks to be able to withstand at least the initial onslaught or the initial economic and financial consequences of the pandemic, which is why, you know, we titled it No Financial Crash Yet, because it wasn't clear then and it's not even clear now the course of that financial crisis. But I don't mean to keep tooting our own horn, but Better Markets also put out a report actually just a couple of weeks ago called The Road to Recovery, Protecting Main Street from President Trump's Dangerous Deregulation of Wall Street. And once again, in that report, we detailed, like we said, it was literally a roadmap to show what actions the regulatory agencies have to take to increase the resiliency of the financial system generally, but also the particular firms, so that it never gets to the point where essentially Wall Street banks take the American people hostage and they say either bail us out or we take you all down with us. And so if you're in the position where it's bailout or economic Armageddon for the country, they're going to bail them out every time. And I disagree with the people who say, oh, after TARP in 08, there'll never be another, you know, bailout. There will be another bailout if the choice, if the only choice is bailout or the financial system collapses, which was, I think most people agree, was the only choice facing policymakers in the fall of 08. Now, that leaves aside the issue. I just want to very quickly say this. Even in 08, when that was the only choice, there were still many choices to be made about the terms and conditions of the bailouts. And the real failure in connection with the bailouts of 08 wasn't necessarily that the government bailed out the financial system. It was that it bailed out the financial system and the banks and bankers with absolutely no terms and conditions. And therefore, they created this moral hazard by incentivizing even greater risk-taking because the industry believed that there would be no consequences to them for that. And indeed, they'd be rewarded for it in a no-strings bailout. That was the problem then. But the real challenge is to make sure the choice is not between bailout and the collapse of the financial system. It has to be on making sure we never get to that point. And that's why the Washington rulemaking and policymaking process at the financial regulatory agencies are so overwhelmingly important, because Wall Street gets its way, not just in times of crisis, but much worse, gets their way day in and day out in the dark corners of Washington, where they're bending the rules and the regulations and the laws to favor them against the public interest. And there's a lot of examples of that. And that's what Better Markets has been fighting against. And in fact, in the report we put out a couple of weeks ago called The Road to Recovery, there's even an appendix in there that lists all the rulemaking in the Trump administration, during the entire Trump administration, and why and how they prioritized Wall Street's interest over Main Street interest and how to fix that. There's another piece to that, though, Rob, that I want to mention quickly, which is enforcement of the law is critically important. And unfortunately, we have a double standard of justice in the United States. There is justice for people on Main Street, and there's a completely separate justice system for Wall Street's wealthy and connected banks and bankers. And there's no better example of that than this. People may have seen this literally yesterday, when J.P. Morgan Chase settled with the Department of Justice, the SEC, and the CFTC. Now, if you just read the articles, you'd have a hard time knowing what was going on. But what happened is J.P. Morgan Chase manipulated the Treasury markets for 7 years. It separately manipulated the precious metal markets for 8 years. The manipulation was so extensive that the Department of Justice referred to J.P. Morgan Chase's precious metals trading desk as a criminal enterprise. It basically was calling it like a mafia operation. And yet, what happened, what the government allowed from Department of Justice, the SEC, and the CFTC, is it allowed J.P. Morgan Chase to settle both of those multi-year-long manipulations of two completely discrete markets in one action and for a grand total of $920 million. Now, $920 million is a lot of money to most companies, and it's certainly a lot of money to every person. But to J.P. Morgan Chase, that total fine was just a little more than 10% of what J.P. Morgan Chase made in the last 3 months of 2019. Think about that. So J.P. Morgan Chase in the year 2019 made $36.4 billion. That's not its revenue. That's its net income, $36.4 billion. And in the last 3 months of 2019, it earned its net income $8.5 billion. So a $920 million fine to a company that generates that level of revenue as a so-called punishment for 7 years of manipulating the Treasury market and 8 years for manipulating the precious metal markets is literally a slap on the wrist. And to add insult to injury, J.P. Morgan Chase, in its settlement, entered into with the Department of Justice what's called a deferred prosecution agreement. And it's set for 3 years, which basically says, don't break the law for the next 3 years. It's like being an individual being on probation. Don't break the law for the next 3 years, and this deferred prosecution will go away. But if you break the law during those 3 years, again, then we will prosecute you for that new law breaking, and the deferred prosecution agreement goes away and we'll prosecute you for the old criminal law breaking. And so that sounds good, because they had to enter this 3 year deferred prosecution agreement, which sounds like kind of a big sanction, until you realize that when J.P. Morgan Chase was manipulating the market in Treasury securities for 7 years and criminally manipulating the market for 8 years in precious metals, it was already subject to a prior deferred prosecution agreement. So what should have happened is J.P. Morgan Chase should have been prosecuted criminally for the new criminal violations as well as for its old criminal violations, but none of that happened. And it's as if they were treated like a first-time offender instead of like a recidivist. In fact, this is the third criminal proceeding against J.P. Morgan Chase in the last several years. The first one was J.P. Morgan Chase actually helped Bernie Madoff get away with his $64 billion Ponzi scheme for decades. And the other criminal proceeding J.P. Morgan Chase was involved in was rigging the foreign exchange markets. And now it's rigged these two markets. And what does it get? It gets a little slap on the wrist as if it's a first-time offender instead of a recidivist. And Better Markets actually put out a report called a rap sheet. We put out a report on a rap sheet showing J.P. Morgan Chase's 20 years of alleged and admitted illegal conduct, which is a rap sheet that is quite shocking. We did the same thing for Goldman Sachs, which is in the same position, engaging in alleged and admitted illegal behavior all over the place for 20 years. And yet the Department of Justice, the SEC and the CFTC and the media, frankly, every time they break the law, they treat each incident as a discrete incident, paying no attention to the multiple serious criminal and civil violations they've been subject to. Any other business or person in America with a rap sheet like J.P. Morgan Chase or Goldman Sachs would A, be put out of business, and B, be put in jail. And in the country today, and you alluded to this earlier, Rob, there's a lot of attention on the unfairness, inequality, and discrimination in our law enforcement and so-called judicial system. And justice is supposed to be blind. And yet, not only is it not blind, the most favorable treatment possible is doled out for the richest, biggest Wall Street banks in this country time and time and time again, and nobody says anything about it. And that's a bipartisan problem. Same thing happened under the Obama administration when Eric Holder was the attorney general, and now it's happening again under the Trump administration. And until the crime spree on Wall Street is stopped, and the crime spree in finance is stopped, until finance has to really pay, you know, individuals are personally prosecuted and fined and sent to prison and barred from the banking industry, and until banks like J.P. Morgan Chase, instead of getting a slap on the wrist for in small amounts, which even the fines, they only use shareholder money to pay those fines. It's not like any individual pays them. And we've been saying for years, and to the Department of Justice and elsewhere, banks don't commit crimes, bankers do. And until you start prosecuting bankers, the crime spree on Wall Street will continue. So we not only have these structural changes that we absolutely have to put at the top of the post-pandemic agenda, creating a Department of Economic Security, reining in the Federal Reserve's unlimited bailouts of Wall Street, we also have to get serious about enforcing the law equally on Wall Street like we do on Main Street. If we don't, then we're going to continue to have, as you know, Paul Volcker was concerned about, as Adair Turner brought up, as many others have brought up, we're going to continue to have this moral hazard on Wall Street where they are actually rewarded and incentivized not only for reckless conduct, but for actual criminal conduct that has very serious consequences, not only for our financial system, but for Main Street consumers and investors. And that's got to stop. That has to be at the top of the post-pandemic agenda to deal with an unfair, unbalanced economic system and an unfair, unbalanced, unstable, and unregulated financial system.
Just over a month's time, we face a presidential election. And I'm reminded of 2016, where a man named Donald J. Trump would walk around and say, "The system is rigged." And what he did was he mowed down, I think, 15 Republicans before he beat Hillary Clinton, because people smell the rat. They can sense these kinds of, we might call selective enforcement of the law or distortions in the structure of the law. And it doesn't feel like governance for the people. And what concerns me was, while I think Trump's diagnosis on his bumper sticker of the system is rigged attracted people, maybe we're now at a place where his prescribed remedies were what people call a seduce and abandon of those original premises that attracted people to his side. But if despondency grows deeper, Dennis, I am concerned about the loss of faith in expertise, in governance, and so forth, leading to an authoritarian void. And it's not at all clear to me how we get back on the what I'll call the healing trajectory to restore faith in the institutions of democracy. But it sure sounds to me like what you might call large entities and wealthy individuals as donors refracting representation for their own financial well-being is playing a very big role in this despondency and should must be reformed, whoever becomes our next president.
Well, you know, I think it is easy to become despondent when you look at kind of what's happening. And, you know, and President Trump, unfortunately, has accelerated cynicism and despondency. I mean, you know, candidate Trump in 2016 was the most anti-Wall Street candidate since FDR in 1932. And yet, when he got into office, he embraced Wall Street and made their agenda his priorities. It was a flip-flop of historic proportion and a level of cynicism that was almost beyond imagination. And he has also kind of turned, he correctly diagnosed the problem with the swamp. Unfortunately, he made it so much worse that he's turned the swamp into a cesspool that's largely populated with these grifters who are his campaign contributors, his family members, and various hangers-on, including many who have cycled in and out of his administration to become sellout influence-peddling lobbyists. All of that can cause people to kind of hang their head in cynicism and despondency. But at Better Markets, I mean, we actually have to be optimistic. We go to work every day and act as a counterweight to Wall Street's influence, power, and expertise throughout the Washington policymaking process. And we take heart in really a number of things, two of which I've actually mentioned. One is the fact that this country has and did for many decades rein in and regulate Wall Street and finance in a way that not just avoided crashes, but actually provided the financial fuel to create the largest middle class in the history of the world. That's what we did after World War II. And we did it because we had a financial system that actually served society and supported the real economy, jobs, and growth. Now, the problem is that the financial industry is almost inevitably going to push the boundaries and tends to excess, if not reined in. And sustaining that over time is difficult. But because it's difficult doesn't mean it can't be done. And as I say, we know objectively history teaches us that it can be done if we have the political will. So we know it can be done. The other reason people should take heart is in the face of the most powerful industry in the history of the world, Wall Street and the financial industry, our government nonetheless came together and enacted the largest package of financial reforms in 2010 in the Dodd-Frank Act since the 1930s. That was a massive defeat of the financial industry and all its money, power, might, and connections. Now, it's true, Dodd-Frank was not perfect, but you know, no law passed in a democracy is perfect. Every law is the product of compromise. And in fact, that's the bedrock principle of democracy. Hopefully, the compromise nonetheless prioritizes the public interest in a way that it can be effective and serve Main Street families and businesses. And that law is well on its way to being implemented largely as designed and largely accomplishing the goals that were set out. And so the Trump administration has been a serious setback to that effort, as well as to many other efforts. It's been a serious setback to the environmental regulations and law and lack of progress. It's been a setback on the health front. It's been a setback on stopping, you know, draining the swamp and stopping the influence peddling, the grifters and the ripoffs of the public interest. But it is a setback, and the American people now have an opportunity to voice their views once again and decide which road they want to take. The other thing that I think people should be encouraged about is that, you know, there's been a significant amount of accomplishment on many public interest issues over the last 4 years, as this administration, this president and this administration, have pushed more and more extreme policies that are really serving narrow private interest, be it Wall Street or something else. There's been significant pushback by the American people, be they through different agencies or organizations like Supporting Better Markets, which, you know, we would encourage people to do. We're a 501c3. We only exist because of support from the public. But we're not the only one. There are a bunch of others. And it's both in the financial area, in the environmental area, in the healthcare area, the energy area. You could kind of go through each area. So it is sometimes, I think, easy, particularly if you just read the headlines, to become cynical or despondent or paralyzed or check out. On the other hand, people need to take a deep breath and say, you know what? There's more of us than there are of them. And if we the people, if people on Main Street families and businesses, the 90%, if only a small fraction of the 90% get engaged, make small contributions to organizations that they care about that advocate for the public interest, if they get engaged by calling congressmen and senators or showing up in their office in their district and telling them what they want to do, if only a small fraction of the 90% get engaged, the 10% can't win. And history shows that. And what people have to do is show up, stand up, speak up. And if they do, policy will change, things will get better, the public interest will be prioritized, and Main Street families and businesses will become a priority of this government in a way that, unfortunately, Wall Street and other special interests have. The special interest of Main Street families and businesses need to be the priority, and we're not that far away from making that happen. And a few more people getting involved in every city and town in America will change the tide relatively quickly. So we're optimistic at Better Markets that that can happen. We have a lot of faith in the American people. And we have a lot of faith that when American people get engaged, they can turn their government to serving their needs and not the needs of the special interest.
Yes, from my own perspective, I am grateful for some good luck, because I watched the first presidential debate last night, and I was on the cusp of despondency. And therefore, the good luck I had was that I had scheduled to talk with you today, the day after that, to be reminded by what you've just shared with our audience of who you are, your purpose, your institution, the thing that you and Mike Masters set out to achieve. And you are an example of why people should not be despondent. Because with people like you working diligently inside of Washington every day, that's where what you might call the seed corn of hope originates.
Well, that's nice of you to say. I appreciate that. And, you know, look, with an engaged American public, there really is nothing that can't be accomplished. We just need to, each one of us, do whatever little we can do. And if we do, if people do that, if enough people do that, it doesn't have to be everybody, we will be wildly successful as a country that we can be proud of.
Yeah. Well, Dennis, thanks for being with me today. What I'd like to do is offer and ask if you could come back and join me after the election, when we've got a new president and you can paint the picture. of what you think they need to do in the first 100 days.
Well, thanks for having me. I'd be happy to come back anytime. And if I can, I'd like to end by encouraging people to go to the Better Markets website at bettermarkets.com and see what we're doing and get more educated and get involved. We'd be happy to have any support from anybody who would be willing to offer it.
And I would endorse that support wholeheartedly. Thanks for today. We'll see you again soon.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.